Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. The federal corruption trial of former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan is underway. We'll look at Madigan's fall from power and what it could mean for his legacy. While schools have invested in mental health support for students, what are some of the changes that have occurred? We'll visit one school to find out. The death of Sonia Massey this summer put a focus on what can happen when law enforcement deals with people in a mental health crisis. We'll learn about the alternative responder model. We'll also have the story of a child who suffered a brain injury. As he's grown older, his needs are changing. An Illinois native, Doug Collins, is being inducted into the National Basketball Hall of Fame this weekend. We'll speak with him. And we'll remember a small-town doctor who kept health care affordable for his patients. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The federal corruption trial of former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan and co-defendant Michael McLean got underway this week with jury selection. It has been years in the making, and riding on the outcome is the legacy of a seemingly invincible Illinois politician known as the Velvet Hammer. Dave McKinney has more.
It's March 2019. McLean is inside the office of the new Commonwealth Edison CEO, Joe Dominguez. McLean was ex-Speaker Madigan's closest advisor and ComEd's main contract lobbyist. McLean is justifying to Dominguez why ComEd let Madigan pad the company's payroll with his allies in do-nothing jobs. In short, McLean explains, previous CEOs had always let Madigan do this, giving the company leverage when it wanted something. How do we know this meeting happened? It was secretly recorded.
I don't know if it's his view of ComEd from even the 70s when you know, he got to name people to be meter readers, right? I mean, it's the old-fashioned patronage system, and ComEd played it like
a chip.
You're a ward committeeman, and we have 7 meter readers in your ward, and you can name 4 of them. You know, and that's just the way ComEd was for years.
The feds put that old-fashioned patronage system on trial last spring when they used this recording and dozens of others to convict 4 former ComEd executives and lobbyists, including McLean, of conspiring to bribe Madigan. Now, Madigan himself is on trial, along with McLean, who's facing new charges. Jury selection begins today in what promises to be the most consequential corruption trial to reach the Dirksen Federal Building since Rod Blagojevich's convictions more than a decade ago. For a record-setting 36 years as House Speaker through 7 Illinois governors, Madigan was both celebrated and feared as the most powerful man at the State House. But he's been reduced to a criminal defendant, no longer in control of his fate. That humbling image is jarring to longtime Illinois Democratic political consultant David Axelrod, who first crossed paths with Madigan in the late 1970s as a Chicago Tribune political reporter.
It's hard to compute that this guy who, for more than a generation, was a colossus astride the politics and government of Illinois, is now this diminished figure, you know, standing before the bar of justice.
Madigan faces 23 counts related to racketeering, bribery, and conspiracy. He's accused of overseeing a vast enterprise where he allegedly enhanced his power by pocketing bribes that took the shape of jobs, contracts, and payments for political supporters. Prosecutors also have charged Madigan with illegally hustling business for his law firm.
I'm not endorsing it, but it's been a longstanding practice in this town that ward committeemen and political leaders have a kind of symbiotic relationship with the business community and trade favors.
But as federal law enforcement crusaded to snuff out that old Chicago way, Axelrod says Madigan was caught flat-footed.
He was operating under an old set of rules, and the rules got more exacting, and he didn't make the adjustment.
The feds took a decade to build their case against Madigan using tap telephones, multiple government moles, and undercover surveillance at one of Springfield's best-known Italian restaurants. Madigan has denied criminal wrongdoing. He's argued that recommending people for jobs was one of his core responsibilities as a legislator, and that he never knew anything untoward might be happening. But Robert Garnes, a juror in the ComEd trial, says the evidence that he and his fellow jurors saw last spring left no doubt Madigan knowingly stood at the very top of the bribery org chart.
He definitely knew. There's not a thing that went on that he did not know about, in my opinion. So, yes, he knew about it. And was it wrong? Yes. In my opinion, again, yes, it was wrong.
Garnes says he and fellow jurors found it galling to see how Madigan's political supporters landed high-paying ComEd gigs with no real purpose outside of cashing paychecks.
I wish somebody would pay me for doing the work. You know what I mean? People just like, we're looking at that like, wait a minute. You know, and they, come on.
This trial will lean heavily into some of the same evidence prosecutors presented last spring, but a new face will be front and center in the Madigan and McLean trial, former alderman Danny Solis. He was a City Hall power broker, and he secretly recorded the ex-speaker and others to avoid prison. Prosecutors allege Madigan illegally solicited work for his property tax appeal law firm by partnering with the alderman. The schemes involve an apartment project in Solis's ward, the old post office, and a Chinatown hotel development. Former federal prosecutor and Chicago defense lawyer Dan Purdom says the government has amassed a bundle of damaging evidence against Madigan.
I think you make a pretty powerful argument, though, and all of this evidence, this pile of evidence of kind of despicable behavior is all to benefit him. Is that a coincidence?
But defense attorneys are sure to exploit Solis's embarrassing baggage. Before cutting his deal with prosecutors, the FBI once accused Solis of offering to trade official acts for Viagra, prostitution, and campaign contributions. The defense may also have an opening with last summer's ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court in an Indiana corruption case narrowing the scope of the federal bribery statute used to indict Madigan. But maybe their biggest challenge is saving Madigan's legacy. As Axelrod, an analyst with CNN, says, a conviction will irreparably stain whatever good came from Madigan's tenure as the longest-serving House Speaker in American history.
It's in the first sentence of his obituary. You can't deny the sort of sweeping power that he leveraged over, you know, government and politics in the state of Illinois for four decades. But the way it ended will be the coda on his career.
The case USA v. Madigan is expected to take about 10 weeks, and so it'll take at least that long to find out how loudly that coda echoes on Madigan's legacy. Dave McKinney, WBEZ News.
Six-year-old Sonia Massey was seeking mental health treatment up until the day she died. Her death at the hands of a former sheriff's deputy, Sean Grayson, has wracked the Springfield community and made worldwide headlines. It's led to calls for changing how law enforcement responds to people struggling with mental health needs. Mawa Iqbal has more on what Massey's death can tell us about the alternative responder model.
On July 5th, Donna Massey called 911 to report her daughter was in the middle of a mental health crisis. She tells them she's not dangerous.
She's not a danger to herself. She's not a danger to me. But when she gets upset, then she thinks everybody's after her.
Donna tells a dispatcher that her daughter, Sonia Massey, has paranoid schizophrenia. Donna had tried calling the local hospital's behavioral health unit to avoid the police, but the hospital told her she had to call 911 because Sonia could get in her car and potentially hurt herself or others.
Please don't send no combative policemen that are prejudiced, please.
Okay, well, that would be Donna. They just do their job, okay?
Donna says they will kill her. Later that night, they did. Sonia was fatally shot in the face by an officer who was responding to her call for help. The shooting, following Donna's pleading calls, has many in Springfield rethinking how mental health crises are handled by local law enforcement. Right now, if you call 911 in Sangamon County, they don't have a mobile mental health response team to dispatch.
We don't make a determination at dispatch, you know, as to who might be having a behavioral crisis and who's not. We send somebody boots on the ground to the scene to assess.
Chris Mueller oversees Sangamon County's 911 dispatch center. He says the protocol has been to send officers to de-escalate situations, like talking someone down from committing suicide. But that's changing soon. A state law passed in 2021 is finally being rolled out at the end of this year. It's called the Community Emergency Services and Supports Act, or CESA. It requires emergency responders to refer mental health calls to a new service that can dispatch a team of trained clinicians instead of police. Mueller's 911 center will be one of the first to test out this new system.
We're going to be more frontline, maybe determining, hey, this maybe needs a behavioral health right off the bat, as opposed to sending an officer, having them assess.
Dr. Lori Rickman-Jones is with the College of Social Work at the University of Illinois Chicago. Jones is in charge of training mobile crisis response teams, 911 and 988 suicide helpline operators in preparation for the new law's implementation.
We know that there have been some unfortunate outcomes when law enforcement gets involved in managing, trying to manage a person with a behavioral health crisis, and making changes in the system can mitigate some of that.
But even the biggest advocates of CESA say it likely wouldn't have prevented Sonia Massey's death this past July. That's because the call that brought Sean Grayson to her home was about a potential crime taking place.
CESA would not have changed that in any way. This call, a person called about a prowler. The response when you call with a prowler is to get law enforcement.
Jones says the answer might be better training for police on what to do when they get on the scene and encounter someone in crisis. But she says that goes beyond the scope of the new law. In the meantime, Springfield's Black community is reeling and leaning on each other while searching for solutions. Local advocates are offering free counseling sessions and healing circles led by Black clinicians to address racialized trauma. And some community members, including Sonia's cousins, are on the Sonia Massey Commission. It's an initiative of the Sangamon County Board to study, among many other things, responding to people with mental health needs. I'm Mawa Iqbal.
Schools have invested millions in mental health support in the past few years. Peter Medlin shows us what that looks like for students at a Northern Illinois middle school.
Ava Peterson is an eighth grade student in Crystal Lake, and last year, during spring break, her friend messaged her. One of their friends might be in trouble. They seemed depressed, and she was worried something bad could happen. She didn't know what to do, but she thought Ava would.
It was over spring break, so there was no trusted adults at school that I could talk to. So I ended up calling for a wellness check just to make sure that person was okay.
Thankfully, they were. And after break, Ava told a school counselor to check in on their classmate.
They could have needed serious help, and if no one was there to help them, then you would never know what was going to happen.
Her friend thought she could help because Ava's a member of her middle school's Hope Squad. It's where students receive suicide prevention training from mental health specialists. They learn to spot the flashing warning lights of a potential crisis. And Ava and the Hope Squad are elected by their peers as people they can trust and they can come to if they don't know where to turn. She says most kids prefer talking to someone their age first because they might feel like they're going to get in trouble if they tell an adult. And in its first year or so, Ava says the Hope Squad has helped dozens of fellow students connect with the supports they need.
Kids shouldn't need to struggle by themselves. I think they should be able to get the help that they need so they can feel better.
And now her classmates at Crystal Lake District 47 have even more mental health resources within reach. All the district's kindergarten through eighth grade students can get free one-on-one teletherapy sessions. It's through a partnership with service provider Daybreak Health that was funded through a federal school-based mental health services grant. Kristen Schmidt is the district's director of social emotional learning and a therapist herself. And she says schools have taken on a bigger role when it comes to their students' mental health care.
Our priority should be on them being able to access their learning environment. But for some students, those mental health needs kind of preclude them from being able to do that.
The U.S. Department of Education grants also allowed them to hire more in-person clinicians, and those local clinicians can then refer students for teletherapy. That includes one-on-one therapy for students older than 10 and family therapy for even younger students. And while Daybreak works with schools across the country, Crystal Lake 47 is the first district in Illinois to partner with it to provide this kind of teletherapy support. Schmidt says this isn't supposed to replace in-person therapy services, but it gives families more flexibility.
There is an accessibility barrier, whether it's born out of insurance or finance or transportation, or just the mental health needs of the parents potentially for being able to manage what needs to be managed to get the kids what they need.
Dozens of students received therapy when they slowly rolled it out last spring, but now even more students are taking advantage of it. The district's contract with Daybreak runs through the school year, and Schmidt says they may continue it depending on how well it works for students. They won't just measure success by how many students use it. They'll also see if it translates to student success.
Maybe it's looking at office discipline referrals. Maybe it's looking at suspensions. Maybe it's looking at absentee rates, things like that, nurses' visits, things that we would look at that would be data points to kind of speak to what improved outcomes look like for students when their mental health needs or behavioral health needs are addressed.
Schmidt says she'd love it if more schools could offer this level of mental health support, especially with the help of federal grants like theirs. Crystal Lake was one of over 100 school districts across the country to receive the grant last year. And back at her middle school, Ava's now helping train other students new to the Hope Squad. She tells the new sixth grade students to take their friends' warning signs seriously. When someone's struggling, it takes a lot to reach out, even to a friend you trust. So she says you owe it to them to help, especially since she and her classmates now know where to find it. I'm Peter Medlin.
A new poll from the state's largest teachers union finds roughly 60% of Illinois educators are considering leaving the profession. Anna Savchinka has more details.
The Illinois Education Association poll found that the main factors prompting educators and support staff to consider switching careers are an increased workload, not enough pay, and a general lack of respect for their profession. Al Lorenz is the president of the IEA.
At the same time that folks are feeling undercompensated, they're being asked to do more and more. In this profession, there are people that are called to do this. However, the calling should not be a vow of poverty.
Lorenz said an increase in state funding for Illinois schools could help entice more teachers to stay in their professions. I'm Anna Savchenka.
Still ahead on Statewide, what did the pandemic do to teenage brains? We'll have that story. That's on the way. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A recent study published by the National Academy of Sciences suggests teenage brains are maturing faster than usual as a side effect of the COVID-19 pandemic. Lauren Warnicki has more.
Researchers looked at the cerebral cortices of teens before and after the pandemic. They found differences in the 4-millimeter outer layer of the brain responsible for memory, reasoning, and problem solving. They found accelerated thinning equated to about 4 years of extra aging in girls. That's compared to just over 1 year in teenage boys.
These findings are kind of startling if you just look at the headline.
That's clinical psychologist Kyle Berkey. He's the director of behavioral sciences at OSF in Bloomington. Berkey noted the study's limitations, including a small sample size.
But I think it's a great conversation point that we're starting to look at what the true impact of the pandemic was. But I think from my perspective, more important than figuring out what has occurred is that we start to think about what we need to do in the future instead.
According to Berkey, the COVID-19 virus is not the root cause of this advanced maturation of the brain. It was the lack of social activity. The areas of the brain most affected deal with processing of emotions, empathy, and language centers. Teens' relative fluency with social media and online communication provided alternative sources of interaction during the pandemic when face-to-face conversations were not an option. But Berkey says teens have not returned to pre-pandemic socialization.
When I'm relying upon two-dimensional social interactions where I'm not picking up as much on a three-dimensional, you know, facial cues and all of that, I think that's where we're seeing some of this, you know, come from.
Teens likely aren't the only age group impacted by social gaps during the pandemic, but it is a particularly important time for brain development. In addition to physical maturation during puberty, teenagers experience rapid social emotional growth as they shift their primary social interactions from their parents to their peers. Berkey says brain development during adolescence is, quote, already a very complicated place, and that's before a world-shifting pandemic.
Not to mention, you know, stress. We know that cortical thinning comes a lot from stress. And all of us, whether we are adolescents or adults, we were all under a lot of stress during, you know, the peak of the pandemic.
Berkey cautions against jumping to the conclusion that teens are experiencing negative outcomes due to cortical thinning. He says these are not problems so much as they are observations. And it invites a conversation around social media's role in teens' social lives.
I think the role is to help facilitate in-person interactions. And unfortunately, it's moved to where the social media is the social interaction. And that's really what we need to be cognizant of. Use it to find others, link up with people who have similar interests, and be able to then get those in-person social interactions because of using the tool.
Perhaps the biggest takeaway from the study, which was published last month by a National Academy of Sciences journal, is the gender gap. With teen girls' brains affected four times that of boys, Berkey notes the extra importance of face-to-face interactions for girls.
Females have a tendency to be more one-on-one and communicative, where a typical male might be totally content to just sit there and watch TV next to their friend and think it was a great social interaction.
Recent data also shows girls may be more negatively impacted by social media. In 2021, a former Facebook employee leaked documents showing teen girls experience worsened body image and increased eating disorders after using Instagram, in part because the algorithm has been tuned to feed teens with unrealistic images and advertisements promoting dieting. The Mayo Clinic suggests parents set realistic boundaries on social media, such as limiting devices at the dinner table or in bed, and discussing positive ways to use social media.
Lauren Mornicki with that report. Pearson Eaker was not quite 2 years old when he suffered severe head trauma at a licensed daycare facility in Illinois. A decade later, he requires care around the clock. Pearson is also growing and thriving, and his needs are changing as he nears his teenage years. Jane Carlson has that story.
Like any 12-year-old boy, Pearson Eaker cracks up at certain bodily functions and sometimes rolls his eyes at his parents. He likes fireworks, splash pads, and bumper cars.
Is this the real life?
And he loves Queen.
Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality.
Pearson has a trach and a G-tube. He communicates with animated facial expressions, huge grins, laughs, and sounds, and through an eye gaze device from his wheelchair.
Do you like your eye gaze, Pearson? Yeah.
This is Pearson's nurse, Stacy Hawkins.
Pearson is awesome. He displays personality and wants and needs every day. He makes choices and he gives facial expressions to say whether or not he cares for whatever it is that's happening.
Hawkins is one of two nurses that care for Pearson in his parents' Monmouth homes.
Your turn. Yay! There you go.
And she's been with the family since Pearson was 6 years old.
Again. Yay!
Pearson's days start with putting on a shaking vest to loosen secretions in his chest, followed by a breathing treatment. He has a pump in his abdomen that helps with muscle rigidity and another in his collarbone that stops him from having seizures. His eye gaze device is called an Accent 1400. It helps him make choices, like what he wants to wear to school that day, and what songs he wants to listen to on the way there.
So this has lots of vocabularies or menus to choose from. He can pick letters in his name. These are all of his songs for the mornings. So just for an example, the number songs, he can look at it and then he can tell you which one he wants to hear.
Where's the star at? Or the triangle. Can you find one of those?
Rectangle.
Okay.
Triangle.
Right? Good job.
Triangle.
Good job.
Pearson Eaker is a victim of shaken baby syndrome. When a child is shaken so violently, the brain bounces back and forth inside the skull. There are around 1,300 reported cases of shaken baby syndrome a year in the U.S. 1 in 4 victims does not survive. Of those who do survive, 80%, like Pearson, suffer lifelong disabilities. Pearson's mom, Candace, says she and his dad, Tim, made a pact to stay positive.
It's not good to be negative about the situation. We have to make of it what it is. We're pretty positive, and Pearson, you know, is thriving compared to how he could be, because we could have lost.
But February 14th, 2014, is stamped in their memories. That Valentine's Day, they dropped off toddler Pearson and his infant brother Lincoln at a licensed daycare home in Charleston. Tim got a call just before noon that Pearson wasn't breathing.
Before 2/14/14, Pearson was a walking, rambunctious, talkative, slight attitude, 23-month-old boy. Enjoyed watching Disney movies, enjoyed music prior to as well.
Pearson was rushed to a local hospital and then to a trauma center 60 miles north in Champaign-Urbana in the middle of a terrible snowstorm. Tim says on the way there, he and Candace were sure they'd be coming home by the next day.
It wasn't until the next morning that the team, I think it was a neurosurgeon or a neurologist, that basically said that Pearson has sustained a traumatic brain injury and that we weren't sure if he was going to come off of life support.
Tim and Candace stayed in hospitals and rehab facilities with Pearson from St. Louis to Chicago for around 200 days after that.
Getting to come home, Pearson was definitely a totally different little boy, but he was breathing on his own.
Tim and Candace and the boys moved to Western Illinois to be closer to Candace's family. The couple later divorced, but lived just a few minutes away from each other in Monmouth. They share parenting responsibilities. They keep the pact to stay positive. And they have an open-door policy if either wants to see the kids at each other's houses at any time. Candace says the brothers are very close.
Lincoln's never known Pearson any different than how he is now. They've grown together like this, and Lincoln is just the sweetest to him and plays with him, talks with him, gets him to laugh, and it's a really special bond that they have.
Though Pearson's family remains positive, there have been dark days. The woman charged with shaking Pearson and causing his injuries was found not guilty. Experts testified Pearson's injuries could not have been caused by a fall, like the woman claimed, but a jury found reasonable doubt. And Pearson's family has been left to wonder what's next, to question why this happened. Why Pearson?
If a child is crying or not doing what you need the child to do, you can just walk away without getting into too many details. Clearly that didn't happen that day.
And through a decade of procedures, surgeries, and hospital stays, Pearson's family didn't always know if he was going to make it home. But Pearson always has.
The last major surgery was spinal fusion, which 2 rods and 27 screws to keep him straight and upright. And that procedure was done 2 years ago. And since then, he's been making the family room his bedroom.
Here's the situation now. Like other 12-year-old boys, Pearson is growing. He's 5 feet tall and 100 pounds now. He's expected to grow 6 feet tall and reach up to 160 pounds. It's getting harder to pick him up and carry him. At his dad's house, Pearson's wheelchair is too big to make the sharp right turns in a narrow hallway to his bedroom. Tim says it's time to build Pearson the space he needs so he can continue to grow and thrive.
We're currently working with a builder out of Peoria to add on a bedroom, closet, bathroom space just off the current living room.
The new space will have a sleeping area, a therapy area, a bathroom with a tub that Pearson can be lowered into for a long soak. It will also have a ceiling track lift system to transfer him safely, and a door that closes so Pearson the teenager can play his music as loud as he wants.
Thunderbolts and lightning, very, very frightening me.
The addition to Tim's home will cost $200,000. Some of that has already been raised, and the builder is helping with materials. They have a goal now to raise $100,000 for Pearson's new space.
He's gone through a lot, so we just want to be able to make him as comfortable as possible as we continue on this journey.
For more on Pearson's journey and his current needs, and to help build him his new space, you can visit Pearson Strong for more information. That's PIERSENstrong.org or Pearson Strong on Facebook. I'm Jane Carlson.
Four Illinois state parks now have free public charging stations for electric vehicles. Governor J.B. Pritzker says the chargers will help the state reach its goal of zero greenhouse emissions by 2050.
It's a milestone that brings us closer to reaching our, well, somewhat ambitious goals of encouraging a reduction in fossil fuel emissions, advancing further EV adoption by making charging more convenient for people.
The Illinois Department of Natural Resources will install an additional 40 charging stations at other state parks, beaches, and museums in coming years. There is a fruit that grows throughout nearly half of the U.S. that most people have never tried. It's called the pawpaw. While the fruit trees are native to much of the Midwest and East Coast, you won't find them in many grocery stores. Kate Grumke with Harvest Public Media reports on the push to popularize the elusive pawpaw.
Here at Earth Dance Organic Farm School in Ferguson, Missouri, the pawpaw trees are covered in bunches of green fruit. This farm first harvested pawpaws in 2018. That was also the first time Jenna Hood tasted the fruit.
It was so tasty. People describe it as a cross between a mango and a banana. And I think that's spot on, really.
Hood is the Director of Agriculture and Education here at Earth Dance Farm. This year, Hood says they'll produce about 800 pounds of pawpaws. That won't keep up with demand.
People call wanting to know, do we have pawpaws? We always sell out.
The pawpaw is shaped kind of like an avocado, except it's got smooth lime green skin. These ones are brown in some spots, which means they're sweet and ready to eat. Sometimes harvesting is as easy as collecting fruit that's already fallen from the tree. Or there's another way. Assistant Farm Manager Will DeLacy grabs a trunk and shakes it.
Honestly, like my favorite part is when you shake it and you hear do 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 do. All right.
The pawpaw is the largest fruit native to North America. It was domesticated by Native Americans and has a range from Nebraska, Kansas, and Oklahoma all the way over to Washington, D.C. For a long time, people ate wild pawpaws straight out of the woods. But now people are growing them on farms. And some are working on cultivating more marketable varieties. Adam D'Angelo is the founder of Project Pawpaw, which is a crowdfunded breeding and research program.
There's so much variation that with a bit of properly directed traditional plant breeding, we could make massive improvements and really just end up with a fantastic crop that's easy to grow, fun to eat, and profitable for the small farmer.
D'Angelo, who's based in Wisconsin, says because the tree is native, it's low maintenance. That means less need for expensive and environmentally harmful fertilizers and pesticides. But there's one big thing holding pawpaws back from a mass market. They don't keep very long.
The chief limitation is the almost ephemeral nature of the fruit.
Pawpaw festivals are a way to take advantage of that short shelf life, says Chris Schmiel.
Instead of that being a limitation, you kind of turn it into an asset by having an event.
Schmiel founded what was likely the first pawpaw festival in the U.S. in 1999.
So over the last 26 years, you know, things have dramatically changed.
The annual festival in Albany, Ohio now draws about 10,000 visitors. Schmiel says similar festivals are popping up all over the country. At the first annual pawpaw festival in Ferguson, Missouri, farmers from Earth Dance are selling fruit to a line of people. Some of the customers already know what they're getting into. Will Colbert is wearing a pawpaw shirt and holding a new live pawpaw tree.
Well, I had them like maybe 2 years ago and fell in love with them. I mean, such like a cool like tropical fruit in Missouri is kind of wild.
But for a lot of people, this fruit is totally new. Tamara Berger is holding her first carton of pawpaws and steps up to check out.
Welcome to Pawpaw Fest.
Thank you.
Have you tried them before?
I have not.
Oh my gosh. You're gonna love
We step behind the booth and borrow a knife from another vendor. Berger cuts into the pawpaw like an avocado and picks out some of the soft pulp.
Oh, it is very, like, I get the custardy. Yeah, it kind of tastes like pudding. I'm into it.
Berger thinks these pawpaws will be especially good blended into a smoothie. For growers, they hope more people will take their first bite soon. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Kate Grumke.
Where, oh, where is dear little Susie? Where, oh, where is dear little Susie? Where, oh, where is dear little Susie? Way down yonder in the pawpaw patch. Come on, boys, let's go find her. Come on, boys, let's go find her. Come on, boys, let's go find her. Way down yonder in the pawpaw patch. Picking up pawpaws, put them in your pocket. Picking up pawpaws, put them in your pocket. Picking up pawpaws, put them in your pocket.
A closer look at the ag economy, that is on the way here on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Over the last 2 years, agriculture has been riding the highs of elevated crop prices and record incomes. But farm income is expected to dip this year. Will Bauer reports on what that means for farmers and the larger ag economy.
After days of rain, fifth-generation Illinois farmer Nick Kohler is finally able to get into his cornfields.
Now today's a beautiful day for harvest, nice blue skies.
The last couple of years, the prices were really good for Kohler's corn, wheat, and soybeans, meaning a pretty good profit. But this year, with lower crop prices and thinner profit margins, he's thinking twice about spending on big items.
We're kind of at the necessity purchases right now. If we need something, we're going to make it work. But, you know, we're not going to maybe look to upgrade anything this year.
As Kohler starts up his combine, he says he'd rather fix big equipment like this than trade it in. That fiscal caution among farmers like Kohler is already impacting the ag equipment sector. The biggest player in this space is John Deere.
It's the first year of a downturn.
That's Mig Dobre. He's an analyst of John Deere for the financial firm Baird. Dobre has watched as Deere's equipment sales dropped by 20% last quarter. In turn, the ag machinery giant has cut production, and that's led to hundreds of layoffs in states like Iowa and Illinois.
In our opinion, this is going to stretch into 2025. It's pretty unlikely to experience a one-year downturn when it comes to farm equipment demand. These downturns are usually anywhere between 2 to 4 years. And our view is that this one is probably going to be probably a 2 to 2.5 year downturn.
And Dobre says Deere isn't alone. Initially, the U.S. Department of Agriculture thought the broader ag economy was going to be much worse. Earlier this year, the USDA projected farm income would dip 26% from last year. This fall, the agency updated its projections. Instead, farm income will drop by just 4.5%. Agricultural economics professor Joe Jansen at the University of Illinois says farm income is returning to more normal levels.
It's a situation that obviously is difficult for the farmer because they are getting squeezed. Profitability on the farm is going to be very difficult to come by, but that's sort of not anything that U.S. agriculture is doing. It's driven largely by global commodity markets.
Global supply has grown, meaning there's less demand for U.S. crops, and that's driven prices down. With less money coming in, some farmers are also holding off on buying land. Tim Johnson is an area vice president for Farmers National Company, which specializes in ag real estate. Johnson says prime farmland is still generating demand, but lower tier farms, not as much. Johnson says interest rates are also a factor.
When you deal with the volume of what these land prices are, that interest rate really adds up quickly. And so that truly causes a level of conservatism to come into play.
Land is a tricky one, though. It may only become available when a neighbor retires or someone dies, meaning farmers might have to take the risk even when the economics aren't working in their favor. And another trend economists are seeing is that farmers are taking on a little more debt. Economist Ty Kreitman with the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City says that makes sense since farmers don't have as much liquidity, meaning cash, as they did before.
The past couple years, loan demand was sort of subdued because there was a lot of liquidity. And now we're sort of seeing that liquidity is sort of running down, and now we're seeing higher usage of debt.
And the USDA is projecting that bankruptcy rates will increase in 2024 after record lows last year. At the same time, there are some bright spots. The Federal Reserve cut interest rates by 0.5 point this fall and could make more cuts later this year, making loans less expensive in the long run. In Godfrey, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Doug Collins is a basketball legend across Illinois. He grew up in the southern Illinois town of Benton, went to Illinois State University, and after an Olympic and NBA career, he wound up as a coach, including a stint with the Chicago Bulls, before becoming a television analyst. Now he's set to be inducted this weekend into the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame in Springfield, Massachusetts. He spoke with Eric Stock. He says it's difficult to condense a lifetime into a 10-minute speech.
It's not hard to write it. What's hard is the time frame you have to deliver it. You know, when you take 50 years, Eric, it's tough to squeeze into 10 minutes. I have so many things that have happened at high school, Illinois State, the Olympics, Sixer player, four-year coaching in the league, broadcasting. So I want you to now take that and give me a 10-minute speech.
I feel like that's what we're about to do here, too. It feels like each chapter in your basketball career could be its own book. And I wanted to start with Illinois State University for newer fans who may not know the origin story. As you said, coming up as perhaps a late bloomer in high school, how did you end up at ISU?
Well, I'll give you a little idea of where I fit in Benton High School basketball history. I played for Rich Herron there, who was my hero. I just wanted a jersey. I never thought I'd even play. I'd be good enough to play, Eric. My freshman and sophomore year, we were number one team in the state. We were 31-0, 30-0, and only lost one game each year. Now, obviously, I didn't play on that team. So when I came to Illinois State, I was very fortunate. I got the first full Division I basketball scholarship they'd ever given. When I came there, a lot of the connection was Coach Colley, who recruited me at the time, who was just an amazing gentleman and a terrific coach. My high school coach, who I told you was my hero, Rich Herron, played for him at McHenry College. Also on that team was Dale Cruz, who was the freshman basketball coach at Illinois State, along with George Terry. So getting to Illinois State, my life changed. My freshman year at Illinois State, I grew 4 inches and gained 20 pounds. So I went from 6'2 and 155 to 6'6, 175, and my whole life changed. And that spring, Coach Colley got MS and had to step away from coaching. There's so many mentors in my life, but Milt Weisbecker, who was the athletic director there, who became just a rock solid, confident guy. I loved him. He stood up for me in my wedding, and he became such an important friend in my life. He went to Detroit, Michigan, and he hired a man of color, Will Robinson, 61 years old, to come down to Illinois State in 1970. And you can only imagine the courage that must have taken to step out like that and say, I'm going to go get this guy who's a champion in Detroit, Michigan, to come to be my coach. He mesmerized me the minute I met him. I looked into his eyes, and this guy was a special man. And I just thought that we could make a great connection, and we did. You know, I had a chance to leave Illinois State at the end of my junior year to go into the NBA to play for the Chicago Bulls. Mm-hmm. And I decided I wanted to make the Olympic team. Don Franke was my dear friend and still is today. And we jumped in his – we had a meeting with Herb Rudoy, came down, put a presentation together of let's go sign with the Chicago Bulls. They'll draft me. This is the four-year contract they'll give you. More money than I'd ever seen in my life since I had about $100 to my name. Went down to spring break with Don Franke, came back, said, I'm staying at Illinois State. I'm going to go make the Olympic team. And I just said, I'm going to bet on myself. I want to find out how good I am. And so had I left early, there would be no jersey retirement, nor name on the court, no statue. And I would not have been a part of Illinois State the way I am today. It's one of the happiest moments of my life to when I come back to Illinois State. I have such great memories, Eric, that I love it there and I love the school.
Given the changes in college sports over the years, and in particular the last several years, if you were a coach today at the college level, how would you handle this new level of empowerment that student athletes have, no limits on transfers and everything that goes with that at a mid-major program?
Well, first of all, I would never coach in college because I could never put up with what's to be in there. I think you saw a lot of coaches my age who were longtime great, great coaches. They're going like, we don't want to live in a world like that. But if I were, I would try to recruit players that when I put them on the court, they would be the kind of player that I would be proud to coach. And I would want them to be guys who love to play for me. and what my vision for them would be.
To many basketball fans, you're remembered as a lead analyst for the NBA and for the Olympics for many years. A lot of ex-coaches and players seem to sort of fall into broadcasting, perhaps just to stay in the game. How did you end up in a broadcaster role?
Well, I think if you would have heard me speak when I was in Illinois State, you would think I would be furthest removed from somebody who was going to be doing the number one announcing team or broadcasting the Olympics or whatever. So I actually, it happened accidentally when I got hurt with the 76ers. I had 3 years left on my deal that they were going to pay me. And they one of the ways they could use me would be if they wanted me to broadcast. I had agreed to either broadcast, general manager, coach. And so they put me on the radio. I was doing the games. I was enjoying it. I was a volunteer assistant coach at Penn. So I was going over and helping Bob Weiner over there, and I was broadcasting Sixers radio, local home games, excuse me. As it happened, Chuck Daly was the assistant coach for the Sixers at the time with Billy Cunningham. Matt Dukas was doing TV, and Chuck Daly left to go to Cleveland at the All-Star break, and Matt Dukas came to be Billy Cunningham's assistant coach. So they had a spot on TV. So they moved me over to television. CBS heard me, and they said, we'd like you to do some playoff games for us, if you would mind doing it. So I did some playoff games. All of a sudden, the Bulls heard me doing TV, and they said they liked my mind, so they'd like me to coach. I want my legacy really to be, and I want to speak at the Hall of Fame for when moments become memories. Because, you know, there's certain things that happen in your life, and I'm sure with you, Eric, whether it be when you got married or when you had a child or whether you graduated from school or when something major happened in your life, that moment becomes a memory to you for the rest of your life. Well, I have so many stories to tell, and it's going to be up for me to try to narrow this down. Eric, the ride that I've been on, I've played with the greatest players. I've coached the greatest players. I've broadcast the greatest players. I've been at gold medal moments. I've seen loved ones win gold medals. My son's got two of them.
Just in our final moments here with Doug Collins, what are you up to these days once the Hall of Fame induction is over? How involved are you still with the game of basketball and anything else that you're up to?
You know, my health has not been great over the last 5 years. I've really suffered with bad neuropathy in my legs and my feet that really prohibit me from doing much travel. I'm incredibly blessed. We're having an after party Sunday after the ceremony. Chicago Bulls are sponsoring it. I think we have 110 people that we've invited to come. So it's not cheap, these tickets to come and to be at the induction on a Saturday night and a Sunday night when people pay their money to fly in for their hotels for their tickets. And for these people to come in and let me know how much they care about me, I'm blessed beyond my wildest dreams.
That's basketball great Doug Collins, set to be inducted into the National Basketball Hall of Fame this weekend. For more than half a century, a Western Illinois doctor made sure health care remained affordable and available for the region's residents. He's being remembered and honored with an exhibit in downtown Rushville. Rich Egger reports.
The $5 Doctor, Leave a Legacy of Good, can be seen at the Hub Arts and Cultural Center. The exhibit shares the story of the late Dr. Russell Doner through display panels and artifacts. His nephew, Mark Doner, says the exhibit is spot on.
Everything that I'm seeing are things that I remember. So is it representative of Uncle Russell? Yes, it is.
Russell Doner opened his practice in Rushville in 1955. He charged just $2 for an office visit for about the next quarter century. He then raised the price to $5 so that he could pay his nurses. That price remained in place for more than another quarter century. Mark Doner says what his uncle practiced was much different than what's seen from the pharmaceutical industry today.
Anyone that wants to see how an old-time doctor operated and functioned, come and take a look, because it's in front of you.
The exhibit remains on display through October 25th. Erin Evelyn is executive director of the Hub. She says the exhibit should be appealing even to people who are not from Rushville.
They should come and be inspired by how much one person can really impact the community by just doing something that might not seem big to them, but is really, really actually very big to the community.
Dr. Doner passed away 9 years ago, but he's still remembered fondly in the town. There's a sculpture of Doner in Rushville Central Park. The plaque next to it thanks him for being a distinguished physician and one of the community's finest citizens. Rich Ecker reporting.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and be sure to be with us next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Find our episodes where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.